Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Nicolas Kenny, the author of The Feel of the City, Experiences of Urban Transformation, and the book was published by University of Toronto Press in 2014. I'm especially excited about this interview because Nicolas is one of my colleagues in the Department of History at Simon Fraser University. And while we both live in the Vancouver area, he's actually joining me from Brussels, one of the two cities that the book focuses on. Hi there, Nicolas.
Hi, Roxane.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, it's a pleasure. I've had the chance to listen to many of your interviews over the last little while, and I'm really honored to be on the other side this time.
Could you get us started by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what got you interested in the questions and issues that you explore in the book?
Sure. Well, the book really looks at, well, as the title says, the feel of the city. What does it feel like to live in an urban environment? And I've always really been interested in cities ever since I was a kid. Really, I just loved the atmosphere, the action, the movement, and as a student living in Montreal, I just really enjoyed walking around that city. And then I got to know Brussels and was fascinated by the architecture and by the layout, and I kept coming back to this question because these were both cities that were really changed in the late 19th century. The way they look today is really a legacy of the late 19th century. And I kept wanting to know, well, what did it feel like? What did it mean to be part of this when it was all happening, when all of this was being created, when it was being built? And I remember the thing that really got me going, I mean, because this book is based on my doctoral dissertation and that project started when I was doing a walking tour. I'd been asked to organize a walking tour of an industrial neighborhood in Montreal, and it was the Faubourg des Récollets, just outside of the old city. And it was an area that during the height of the Industrial Revolution was really an action-packed sort of place. And then after the 30s and then especially after the Second World War and deindustrialization and all that, it had gone sort of dormant. And then this was in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was being kind of reinvested, I guess, reappropriated by the new technology sector. And so they were building these new buildings that were sort of echoing the old factories and warehouses in the area. And so that was what my walking tour was about. But I kept kind of contemplating these old factories and warehouses, places that we think of as being really functionalist places. And yet they were designed with such an attention to aesthetics and detail. And I guess I just wanted to know more about, you know, what was going through people's minds when they were building these cities.
In the introduction to the book, Nicolas, you map out the project as one that seeks to, and I'm quoting here, situate corporeal experiences at the epicenter of urban modernity, and you say that the body played a fundamental role in mediating the relationship between city dwellers and urban environments. So I want to ask you about some of the building blocks of this mission that you're on in the book, some of the key terms and concepts that you are working with and interrogating in the book. And I guess the biggest one is this idea of the feel, right? This idea of sensation and corporeality and the body. And I just wonder if you could say a little bit about, you know, where you see your book making an intervention in these literatures of body and feeling and sensation.
Sure. Well, I think it's a literature that's actually come a long way since I, you know, first started working on this many years ago. Mm-hmm. Back then I was reading about industrialization in these two cities, and I was a little bit frustrated by the way, I mean, there were excellent studies on the topic, but they all seemed kind of dry in a way, very, very much disconnected from this question I was mentioning earlier about the way people actually felt inside when they were experiencing all of this. And so, you know, there's great studies on industrialization as an economic process, the social implications of industrial capitalism and all that. But I guess I wanted to bring it down, and this kind of goes back to what got me interested in the first place. I wanted to bring it down to the level of, you know, the person walking through the street and And that goes back to, again, my own experiences of living in these cities that have been shaped by industrialization and that are still centers of manufacturing in some ways today, though obviously much less. But you smell things, you see things, you hear things. And all of that, for me as an individual, was really shaping the way I thought about and was experiencing and the ideas I was developing about my own environment. And so I guess I wanted to transpose that particular set of questions that I had about my own, you know, my own life in the city and kind of transpose it to this historical period where all this was happening. And so one of the ways, I think, well, there's probably a lot of ways that a person could do that, but what I was attracted to was the work of people like Alain Corbin and Richard Sennett, who Constance Klassen, David Howes, you know, historians, anthropologists, sociologists who put together this idea of history of the senses and problematizing something that really I think we take for granted. And I think the history of the senses now, it's quite amazing to see all the new works that are coming out. But for a long time, these people were really pioneers because sensorial experiences, how something smells, how something sounds, I think for a long time was considered, well, at best something that the historian couldn't really possibly grasp anyway, and at worst something, you know, trivial and didn't really matter and wasn't sort of worthy of serious historical inquiry. Like, so I, you know, I was really interested in kind of taking these sort of big processes like industrialization, like urbanization, and trying to think about them in terms of these very basic day-to-day taken for granted experiences that we have and taking a step back and saying, well, maybe we shouldn't take these things for granted because there's a lot bound up in the way things smell and in the way things sound, right? There's all kinds of social relationships at stake in there. And there's all kinds of cultural constructions at play as well. So I really wanted to, do this, you know, take the study of urbanization and industrialization away from kind of the big meta processes and bring it down to the level of the person walking in the street.
Mm-hmm. And throughout the book, Nicolas, you're also engaged with historical actors, but also historians and other scholars think about this incredibly contested term, modernity. Mm-hmm. So I have to ask you before we go any further, how you deal with modernity, what the term means for you in the book, and how you see the book as a contribution to debates or discussions about that term.
Well, I think that's something I struggled with from start to finish, from the beginning of the project to the very end of it, because modernity is a contested term. It's also a multifarious term. It means all kinds of things to all kinds of different people. And so it's a complicated concept to work with in that sense. It's hard to pin down. It's hard to define, to the point where there's some very respectable scholars who have preferred just to do away with it. And in fact, I was, you know, as I was getting feedback along the way, I had people tell me, well, you know, why do you need to look at this through modernity? Aren't there other ways, you know, what does modernity really mean anyway? How does it matter? But I really stuck with the idea, with the concept, because I think it's, I don't want to sort of recite the whole chapter on it, but I think what it comes down to is that it really, is a useful way of grasping the way people were relating to the changes, the really unprecedented changes going on around them. And in this sense, I was really influenced, like a lot of people who work with modernity, I was influenced by the work of Marshall Berman here and the way he talks about, you know, the movement of the person through the street, the poet and the mire of the macadam and all that, and the way that our environment is in flux, especially in this period of industrial capitalism, of urbanization, right? This is a period in which things, as Berman says, everything seems to be, quoting Marx, you know, everything, all that is solid is melts into, right? Everything seems to be falling apart. People are, you know, sort of don't know where to look anymore to kind of make sense of their world. And so I think using modernity allows us to kind of grasp that sort of questioning that's happening. And it also allows us, this is the other really important thing, I think, is that it allows us to see things not as progress versus backwardness, or, you know, modernity has been critiqued as sort of a propping up really awful things like war and on a global scale and colonialism and these kinds of processes that are seen as, or that were seen at the time as this kind of forward moving progress. So, but modernity isn't necessarily about progress in the sense, as it is about the way some people have sort of used this notion of change and transformation to support a kind of progress oriented agenda. But at the same time, it's also been a space of resistance, of contestation, of pushing back against these trends, right? So I think what modernity allows us to do is to grasp that complexity of change, of how people are relating to it, of this ideology of building the city as a rational, clean, orderly place, set against this kind of resistance to that orderliness, the chaos. It allows us to pick up on that movement, that motion, that chaos. And the other thing, and the last thing I want to say about this, mm-hmm. is that people at the time define themselves as modern. And I think that's important when we consider a historical period. It's less, we need to, whether or not we believe that modernity happened in a certain way or not, the people who we study here in this case certainly saw themselves as participating in something big. And so we need to question, well, what did that mean to them? Right. Mm-hmm. And I think those are sort of the broader questions through which I then wanted to think about how that experience happened, manifested itself on a very kind of tangible level.
So I've asked you about this notion of the feel, and we've sort of just talked about this idea of urban transformation and change. So I want to zoom in on this idea of experience and mm-hmm. how and what that term means for you. I mean, it's certainly a contested term, not just for historians, but other scholars. And I want to ask you sort of more specifically what evidence and sources you used in the book to get at the person on the street, the mm-hmm. experience of this modern urban landscape that interests
sure.
you.
Yeah, experience is indeed it's another one of these kind of contested terms, and especially in the wake of kind of postmodern thought, there's a tendency, I think, at some point to want to question whether experience really means anything, whether it's not all sort of bound up by language, whether what we think of as experience is not in fact kind of a linguistically constructed notion, right? Mm-hmm. And people like Joan Scott and Patrick Joyce have written very interesting work on this. But at the same time, I think what it comes down to is that we still, you know, whether it's linguistically constructed or not, you know, we still feel things, we still smell things, we still hear things, we still see things, and certainly the people that I'm studying in this book were very attuned to these sensorial experiences that they were having. So I think we need to be careful not to reify the these experiences, not to sort of take them for granted as being kind of authentic markers of how things actually were. I mean, the way something smelled or the way something sounded is kind of a basic physiological thing, but then that takes meaning because of the social and linguistic processes through which it gets articulated and this experience enters the discourse, right? But at the same time, there is a fundamental contact between the body and the space in which it's moving. Mm-hmm. So that's where I situate experience. You know, as I said, being careful to consider the social constructs behind that, and so. Where how do you get at that? What I wanted to do here is really try to get a range of sources, and what I found really exciting about doing this research is that it seemed like no matter where I looked, people were talking about their sensorial or corporeal or bodily experiences of the city. No matter what I was reading about any kind of description about the city, it seemed that was the lens through which it was represented. And I thought, okay, well, this means something. If there's this kind of consistent, use of this sort of language in describing the city, I think it's speaking to something, to a phenomenon that's happening. So I really wanted to hear a range of voices and you kind of, it's easy to fall into the trap of kind of focusing on elite or middle class kind of commentators of urban life who wrote really interesting things but who represent a certain kind of viewpoint and those people are definitely there because they dominated they were the people who wrote things down in the late centuries. So you've got a lot of, the first place I looked was in municipal archives, and so you've got the writings of municipal administrators, politicians, planners, engineers, this kind of class of urban professionals that are people that are shaping the city at the time. But at the same time, you've got citizens of urban residents of all sorts of backgrounds writing letters and signing petitions and going to see their neighbors and getting together to complain about the noise that a factory is making or the smell or of something burning over here or whatever and people municipal archives, you end up hearing quite a range of voices of men and women of people from different social background. So there's that kind of sort of formal urban type of urban administration type of source. But then I was really interested too in how people were representing the city in more imaginative ways. So I looked at a lot of fiction, novels and poetry, which again, speak to how people were representing those experiences. I looked at the popular press. I looked at almanacs. I looked at, travel guides.
How did you choose? Yes. I mean, like you say, if this way of talking about things or representing things is everywhere, how did you make some of those choices?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I accepted very early on is that it wasn't going to be an exhaustive overview of every possible perspective on the city. I mean, but I guess I was interested in different uses of urban space, and so this is how the book kind of gets structured especially in the second part of it, The first thing was factories and industry, the industrial world. I was looking at, the reports of factory inspectors. I was looking at testimonials before labor commissions. So in some ways, my starting point was often kind of the well-known sources on those topics that I wanted to kind of read a bit differently because a lot of people have worked with factory inspection reports and labor commissions, but haven't necessarily looked for these kinds of sensorial language in them before. So then the other, another theme was housing. So I looked at the files of organizations, what they called in Brussels, anyway, patronage committees, you know, these sort of very bourgeois kind of charitable organizations, if you will, that were designed or constructed to try to help working, you know, the deserving poor, the, you know, working class people into more respectable types of accommodations. There's this very loaded kind of language in these things about moral propriety and all this, mm-hmm. but it's always sort of, there's always this undercurrent of sensorial language, which again I wanted to tease out. So really, based on the specific kind of theme that I was focusing on, you know, I would start with kind of the sort of classic sources, and then sort of try to branch out a little bit. And again, it goes back to what I was saying about wanting to look at industrialization in a more kind of cultural imaginative way, mm-hmm. I guess, as a cultural problem as opposed to as an economic or a social problem. So I wanted to talk about industrialization, but from the perspective of what, you know, novelists had to say about it, or so I guess to get down to it, it was sort of starting from the well-known sources and then trying to branch out to more kind of imaginative things.
So before we get into talking about the subsequent chapters in the book, I just want to ask you one more kind of setup question, which is that the book covers the period from 1880 to 1914, and that's not, well, it's not an unknown time span. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one that I've seen before, or we've seen before. Can you say a little bit about why you cover that time period, those bookends, what your choice of those two dates reflects?
Yeah, it is a sort of a conventional, in a way, conventional form of chronology, but it's also it works quite well in terms of the experiences of these two cities with industrialization. The 1880s, both Montreal and Brussels really start to pick up after the 1870s with kind of economic crisis and depression and all that. There's kind of a new impulse to industrialization as of roughly 1880, right? These are quite, sure. Approximative dates. And then I take it into 1914, and 1914, the obvious end point, because the war comes and changes everything fundamentally, especially in Brussels, because the city mm-hmm. is occupied by German troops, and so the whole rapport to the urban environment changes, because now all of a sudden you're not in a kind of expanding industrial economy anymore. You're under military occupation, starvation, death, suffering. So it's a very different way of relating to your environment also. And I think the argument works for Montreal as well, in the sense that even though the war is happening in Europe, when you look at this at the way people are talking about the city as of 1914, there's a definite kind of toning down of the excitement. The war is having both an economic but also, I guess, in a way, a kind of a psychological impact on people as well. So it's 1880 to 1914 is in a way. It's a relatively short period, so it allows you to really kind of get into that daily life. It's hard to do daily life, I think, mm-hmm. over 100 years or over 200 years. When you're working with a short period, I think as a researcher, you really get into the atmosphere of the era, and that's what I was trying to do, is trying to tease out the nuances of that atmosphere. So I wanted to focus on something short. I wanted to focus on something that corresponded to a certain set of realities in both of the places that I was looking at, and then I wanted to use this period because it was it was kind of a heyday of industrial modernity in a way.
So, Nicolas, the book is a tale of two cities, to use a cheap reference, Montreal and Brussels. And you're contributing to this, complex and vast literature of urban history and urban geography and ways of thinking about cities, some of it comparative and transnational. But you focused on Montreal and Brussels. So why these two cities? What did they have in common? How did they diverge? What's the setup here in terms of the two places that you've chosen to focus on in the book?
Well, yeah, that's a question I get asked a lot. I think there's a lot of reasons I wanted to work with these two cities in particular. The project started, as I said, I was living in Montreal. I was fascinated by Montreal. I wanted to work on Montreal, but I also wanted to think about how Montreal's experiences reflected in light of what other cities were going through, and in particular in Europe, because this kind of industrial modernity is really kind of a Western phenomenon, if we can say that. I mean, I don't want to imply by that modernity isn't having very real consequences in places that aren't understood as the West. I don't like to say that because it's a really problematic kind of conceptualization. But modernity is happening in Europe and in North America, and both of these societies are shaping one another, and there's a lot of back and forth between these two places. And so I wanted to think about Montreal initially in a broader sense than just Montreal. And I wanted to set it against somewhere else that was in some ways equivalent. And I think Brussels worked well. Paris is always seen as, the capital of the 19th century, the urban center par excellence in this period, and when I teach urban history, there's a lot of material on Paris in my classes because it's such an exciting context to study the city of, you just have to think of the work of David Harvey and so many others, but cities like Montreal and Brussels were in a way more typical of these processes because more people lived in these sort of smaller mid-sized cities that were kind of in the orbit of all these changes and weren't necessarily pushing them forward like Paris was, like London was, like New York would later on, but they were very much very, very influential in shaping the way that urbanization was happening, and in terms of people's experiences, not everybody lived in the small number of big cities. There were a lot more people living in a larger number of smaller cities, if you see what I mean. So so I think I wanted to in some way move away from the big names in the field like Paris, and take it down to these kind of sort of secondary cities that maybe don't get looked at in this particular way all that much, and then of course I wanted to think about cities that when you start thinking comparatively, you want to work with two or more sets of objects that you're comfortable handling together, right? Mm-hmm. So So studying Montreal in a comparison with Paris, I think would have just, wouldn't have worked all that well, because of the difference in scale and mm-hmm. in size and in importance. So Montreal and Brussels are undergoing similar transformations at around the same time. They're also roughly similar in size. They're also cities that are shaped by their cultural diversity, their unique. Both of them have unique kind of location in the natural geography of their respective countries, but also they are participating in these broader trends that are happening on a transatlantic and even a global scale at this time.
In the second chapter of the book, Nicolas, you really focus on the way the city is visually represented. I mean, the book explores the sensory experiences of the city in all sorts of ways. But the visual representation, this chapter was particularly fascinating to me. And you talk about this idea of representing the city and the urban landscape in terms of panorama and labyrinth. And I really wanted to ask you to say more about those two things, those two ways of figuring the city and how they impact the sensory experience of urban life.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting with sensory descriptions of urban centers is the way that the first impulse you get is often a visual one. The descriptions of smell, of sound, of touch are there, of taste even, although those I found a bit harder to get at. But it's really sight that seems to predominate. And this is nothing new. Historians of the senses have long talked about the way that sight was the sort of considered the most noble of the senses, the way mm-hmm. it was the hierarchy of the senses, and sight is at the top because it's understood to be rational, and it's a sight, it's a sense of observation, of knowledge, of authority, of power, of masculinity, all these things. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other senses are especially smell and taste are considered more animalistic and unreliable and instinctive, and they're often gendered feminine to kind of use that analogy. And so I guess I kind of wanted to start with that because it was what jumped out at me the most, and then proceed to unpack it using the other senses. So the notion of panoramas is quite interesting because you get an incredible diversity of panoramic representations of cities during this era. These are often very celebratory images of the city. They're the kind of the triumphalist mode, right? And in a way, when you step back from the action and the movement and the dirt, and you look at the city from afar or from above, everything seems to fall into place, right? Everything seems very orderly. So representing the city through panoramas was a way for the urban bourgeoisie of the time to impose a certain order, to express their mastery over the environment, and so there's all kinds of and they do this in all sorts of ways. So I try to contrast different types of uses of the panorama, and some that really focus on the city as a whole, but leaving out, important things like that big industrial neighborhood right there that that they're not talking about when they're going on about the churches and the monuments and the trees surrounding them, right? So there's a kind of a willful erasing of things that are kind of inconvenient in there. Others use that panorama as a way to take those factories and those smokestacks and those steamships and turn them into something that's aesthetically pleasing and soothing and that signs of progress and of modernity and all that. And so there's all kinds of ways in which the panorama functions to celebrate the city. But then if you contrast that against more descriptions of the city that are sort of on the ground, that are taken from the street, that are taken from the factory, that still consider the city as a whole, because as we'll get to, the other parts of the book try to kind of break up the city. Mm-hmm. But here I wanted to talk about it in its entirety. But all of a sudden, when you step off of the mountaintop or the Belvedere or whatever, and you get down into the street, and then you're confronted with the crowds and with the stench and with the cacophony of the environment, all of a sudden the other senses start to be much more predominant in discussions of the city. So what I wanted to do was really to contrast these two ways of seeing from afar and from within as a way to highlight the multiple manifestations of sensorial experiences in these descriptions of the city as a whole before then, you know, going into the various sections.
So in the second part of the book, you really, do what you just described, this dividing the city up into, well, really you follow kind of the course of the day, right? Work, sleep, mm-hmm. home, leisure, family. So I wanted to ask you about that decision, you know, to break up the book along those lines. And then to see if you could give us some examples of the types of materials that you're working with in those chapters in the book and how they contribute to this kind of broader history of the senses in the urban landscape.
Sure. Well, the idea to break it up into these three. So what I've done is that there's a chapter on kind of the industrial world, you know, the world of the factory of the workshop. There's a chapter on the home, and then the chapter on the street where, you know, kind of people spend important parts of their day at work in the factory or observing the factory, at home, and then in the spaces in between. And this roughly, and the kind of the image I use to illustrate this is this kind of is the 8-hour movement that's very prevalent in Montreal and in Brussels at this time, especially in Brussels where they call it the 3/8. So mm-hmm. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for leisure. And so this is, of course, an ideal way of thinking about time. It doesn't really happen until much later than period. But what's interesting about that way of framing in life under industrial modernity is that it takes a day and it separates it into spaces and into the things that we do in those spaces, right? And so that those were my you know, my fundamental questions about how people were interacting with these spaces. So I wanted to look at these different beats of this rhythm, of this kind of work, sleep, leisure, knowing that, as I say, it's a problematic construct. And one of the things that I point out is that not only is it an ideal that doesn't actually really happen, but it's also a very masculine ideal, right? Because of course the women that I talk about in the book were, except for the ones who worked in factories, this idea of separating the day was well at best a luxury because their work life and their home life was so intertwined, whether their responsibilities were for the home or whether they were doing outside paid labor but in the home, so I'm very aware that this is kind of an image that I'm working with. Mm-hmm. But it allowed me to think about the industrial city as it was being conceptualized in this kind of movement, which was promoted primarily by labor groups and labor political parties, but that also had a surprising following among certain industrialists who thought, well, if we did this, our workers would be better rested and happier and more productive, and everybody would benefit, right? So there was actually a number of capitalists who actually bought into this notion as well, which is interesting. So again, it sort of reaches different ways, different perspectives. Mm-hmm.
So, Nicola, we've talked about the different types of sensation in terms of smell and touch and taste and sight. And I'm just wondering about the way that the book communicates with this exploding literature on emotion and affect. You know, you say the feel of the city. So how do you engage with those other types of feelings in the book?
Well, I think that's what I really liked about the word feel, is that it allows you to access those different dimensions of feeling, both in a kind of physical way as well as in an emotional way. There's kind of a slippage that happens there between the physical sensation and how that gets translated into an emotional reaction. And I think going back to what my objectives with this book was really to think about, okay, how do these brute physical material sensations get translated into ideas, imaginations, conceptualizations of the city. So I really wanted to work with that that duality, right? That notion of feeling having both a physical and a mental sense to it, and kind of thinking about the way that the two shape one another. Now, I think the book really does highlight the physical side of that dynamic. I think there was so much to say in terms of those sensorial experiences of those sounds and smells and all the rest of it, that the emotional engagement with the city I just sort of ran out of time in a way to engage with that as fully as I would have liked to. So I think if I could critique my own work, that's the main thing that I would say. But have no fear that's the next thing I want to
This is kind of dialing back a bit to the discussion that we just had about Panorama and Labyrinth, but I wanted to ask you about some of the new technologies that are emerging in the same period that you're working on, you know, photography, early cinema, some of these kinds of things. And I was thinking as I was reading the book about not only the feel of the city and the experience of the city, but then the bodily experience of experiencing. Yes. I mean, and you talk about this when you talk about Panorama and Labyrinth, and I'm just wondering about, I mean, it's kind of fascinating to me and impressive to me how much you had to take on in doing this study, how you deal with this question of the new technologies that are emerging around the fin de siècle and the turn of the century that you're dealing with in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think those new technologies are interesting because they are generating both new feelings, new sensations. And that's very clear, I think, when I talk about the factories and the machinery and how people mm-hmm. relating to those things through their bodies, the stress that those realities were placing on the body. But they also generate they generate new feelings, but they also generate, I think, new ways of feeling. So I'm thinking mm-hmm. here of work by people like Jonathan Crary who really get into this and what it means, so if you take the sense of sight, well, what that means, what it means to the gaze that is cast upon the city changes because all of a sudden it's being represented in different ways, you know, using different technologies, using, as you say, the start of photography. Photography is a great example. I talk about that mm-hmm. a little bit. People are all of a sudden seeing the city very differently because they're seeing it through the lens of of a camera, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's what's interesting too about this period is that the way that these new technologies are not only the generators of new feelings, of new ways of feeling, but of new sensations, but of new they themselves are, I guess, are playing an active role in shaping that relationship to space.
You talk in the book about, you certainly engage, you know, the lines of class difference and gender, the sort of, especially with respect to the distinctions between, or the kind of leaky distinctions between public and private and home and work. Are there other lines of, you know, when we talk about the body in the city, we know that there are multiple cities and there are multiple bodies. So I just wondered if you could talk about that, the different kinds of bodies that you're dealing with. I even, you know, thinking about this, I was thinking about age, you know, and, mm-hmm. and some of these other things and how you deal with those, all those different types of bodies that are moving in the city.
Yeah, that I think that's a really good question. And it's a really challenging mm-hmm. aspect of doing this kind of work, because you're trying to make, you know, as historians do, we're trying to weave through all this information and try to come out of it with a kind of a vaguely coherent understanding of a phenomena. But at the same time, when we're talking about bodily senses and experience and movement, it's something that, of course, is so individual in a lot of ways, that is shaped by all kinds of things. And the example of the you raised, gender, age, class, ethnicity, ability versus disability, you know, all these things. So, and I try to tease out various examples of that in the book. But in a general sense, I think the way that we can kind of get past that is thinking about the senses in a social context, right? That particular, and I think we can probably say this about the emotions as well, but particular ways of feeling, particular ways of seeing, of smelling, go beyond the individual experience as people kind of share, talk about, you know, actualize these experiences through language. There's broader social meanings that underlay the significance of a particular smell as being equated with something, you know, evil or morally corrupt, versus another one that's associated with cleanliness and a high moral virtue and all that. So it's really much more than just what the individual is feeling, but rather how those sensations start to shape a broader social discourse. So I think we need to be very aware of the multiplicity of sensorial experiences along all kinds of lines that cut across these realities. But at the same time, how there's kind of broader cultural understandings that emerge that are, of course, very contested, right? Just to use some of the examples from the book, how an author of a promotional booklet on Montreal that's designed to attract investors to the city portrays the way of seeing the city differs fundamentally from, you know, the way a socialist author in Brussels talks about the panorama as a way of kind of putting, you know, giving workers their place in that environment, right? So the ways of seeing are conditioned by different backgrounds, by different political agendas, but what sort of comes out of that is that seeing itself, or smelling, or hearing, are ways in which people recognize descriptions of the city, ways of talking about the city, right? Those physical experiences are common reference to understandings of urban space, and from there, of course, they diverge in politics and background and objectives and all sorts of things.
Does the fact that I mean, I know they're not the only cities like this, but does the fact that Montreal and Brussels, you know, I think of them both, having grown up in Montreal, I think of them both as, and visited Brussels, I think of them both as cities where there are different languages at work. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder about the sources that you use and the fact that given different languages, does that make a difference in terms of your reading of the material? How people, well, in the case of Montreal, you know, how people in English or French talk about these things?
Yeah, well, I was really expecting that it would more than it did, and oh. I struggled with this because I was surprised actually by the way that sensorial experiences were conveyed, were laden with meaning that, to me anyway, in my reading of them, was much more class or gender based than it was linguistic. But at the same time, I thought, hey, this is kind of good because, especially for Montreal, it's another way to look at the city that goes beyond. I mean, I think, you know, linguistic tensions are, you know, the bread and butter of Montreal.
Well, right.
So, of course it's fascinating, and I don't want to discredit that. There's excellent problematizing this, but I think we can also think about other ways of experiencing Montreal that weren't necessarily about language per se. And it gets a little bit tricky as well dealing with Brussels, because a lot of people say, okay, well, here you go. You've got two bilingual cities. Well, what does that mean? Mm. Except for their bilingualism is very different.
Sure.
It's much more pronounced in Montreal. The linguistic tensions are much more pronounced in Montreal than they are in Brussels at this time. Mm-hmm. The linguistic kind of divide that hits Belgium happens. It's starting to brew in this period, but it's a society in the early 20th century, at the turn of the 20th century, that is really structured along ideological lines, and the real cleavages in Belgian and in Brussels society is along political lines between Catholics and liberals and an emerging socialist movement. So language is there, but it's not. But it's kind of in Brussels at this time, it's still sort of an abstract political question that's less, I think, related to those kind of day-to-day sensorial experiences. And so I guess what I found was that the way people talked about their physical sensorial engagement with the materiality of their environment was conditioned much more according to their kind of social grouping or whether they were of a certain age or of, whether they were men or women or much more than language. So in a way the issue of the linguistic duality might be something that needs to be looked into more. It's something that I'll be honest is actually somewhat underplayed in this particular work.
I just read this morning, I just read a piece that you wrote, Nicolas, for Niche, which maybe you can tell us about that publication and a little bit in your response. But the piece is called One Flew Over the City, Sensorial Experiences of Urban Space. And it's an article in which you talk about the contemporary issues in Brussels. And I just wanted to use that, I guess, as a point of entry to ask you about what your thoughts are on how the book contributes to our thinking about change and experience in the urban landscapes today in Montreal, Brussels, Vancouver, where we both live. Mm-hmm. What your thoughts are on that?
Yeah. So Niche is the I'm going to get it wrong. New Initiative in Canadian History of the Environment. That's what, and there's also a French acronym for it as well. Mm-hmm. And it's so I was very pleased to be asked invited by the editors of the blog that they run to write a short kind of reflection on this book and on how I see it connecting with the cities that we live in today. And so I think sort of coming full circle to what we were saying at the start, I think I'd set out to do this project because of my own physical questions about my own sort of physical engagement with or sensorial wanderings through the city, and now I guess I can't help but see that everywhere I go. So one of the things I talk about in this article for Niche is that, so I'm living, as you said, I'm living in Brussels now because I'm on research leave for a year, when I got here, there was a controversy that was raging over flight paths over the city. So flights coming in and out of Brussels airports had been rerouted, and suddenly we're going over central residential districts of Brussels. And of course, there's a lot of politics behind this because the kind of suburban communities that had over which much of the air traffic was concentrated before or had enough. There's a certain kind of political spin that gets put on this about how the flights were rerouted for electoral reasons and all the rest of it. But what was really striking about all of this was the way that I arrive in Brussels after not having been here for a number of years, having been here to work on how in the 19th and early 20th centuries people thought about the city in terms of their sensorial experiences, and the first thing I find is this debate that's happening about noise and about the rumblings of the airplane, mm-hmm. and way people can't sleep, and about how they're afraid that their home values are declining, and then all of the houses in my street had these little signs, against this new routings, and then there were these kind of big large signs on apartment buildings. With there's one that really troubling, kind of this young boy is crying, and he's got an airplane like literally flying through his head. So there's this really deep engagement. So I thought to myself, well, this is interesting, this kind of an interesting episode. But in a larger sense, I think what all of this reminds us is the extent to which the my project tried to, in a way, contest or push back against a literature that sees the 19th century and this kind of modernity as rational or orderly imposition on our urban space, mm-hmm. As the beginning of a kind of a desensitization of the body, a sanitation. Mm-hmm. Of the city that I think I'm a huge admirer of the work of Richard Sennett, and he expresses this really well, how especially since the Second World War with freeways and suburbs and the emptying of downtowns, how cities have become these kind of empty, dead spaces that our bodies don't connect to anymore. And I thought, okay, well, I think there's probably a lot of truth to that, but if you kind of, again, if you take it to if you start to look at these questions on a smaller scale of the neighborhood, of the city, of a short period of time, you start to see how these trends, which are attributed to the kind of mid 19th to late 19th centuries, when these scholars start to see it happening. So Corbin, for instance, talks about how our threshold for sense really diminishes really diminishes as of the mid 19th century, and that's when you start to get these kind of dead end cities that we don't really connect with in a physical sense the way that they might have done 200 or 300 years ago, and there's some kind of something lost there, and so part of my objective in doing this project was sort of to problematize that narrative a little bit and say, wait a minute, against these general trends that are, you know, undisputable, we can't assume that all of a sudden the body disappears. We don't maybe talk about it as much as they did in the 19th century, but every once in a while, an episode like these airplanes flying over Brussels reminds us of just how important that sensorial connection is to the way we think about, organize, and structure our relationship to the environment that we live in.
Well, Nicola, there's so many questions I still want to ask you, but I'm only going to ask you one more, which is, what are you working on now?
Yeah, well, all kinds of things, actually. One of the things that I mentioned when we were speaking is that one of the things that the book, to my mind, maybe didn't do enough was get into the emotions, and so I moved much more into that area of inquiry, questioning the sort of downplaying, I guess, the sensorial, which gets a lot of attention in the book, and I'm moving now with a couple of different projects to thinking about the way that gets translated into emotions and how the emotions, again, I think this is part of an emerging field that's really quite exciting, that for a long time, and when I teach historiography, I have texts that I show my students about historians who say, well, you know, we can't possibly get into the emotional lives of people, that there's kind of a line there that is just uncrossable for the historian. We can't go back in time and know how people were feeling. And yet, just like with the senses, the emotions have a real social, cultural meaning to them. And so there's, you know, all kinds of work by people like William Reddy, Barbara Rosenvane, who have really brought this to the fore. And I think there's an exciting opportunity to think about the emotions with respect to city life in particular. So I'm still interested in Montreal and Brussels, but I've actually been working on a piece that looks at street lighting in these two cities and thinks about them in terms of that looks at street lights in terms of the emotional responses that they generated in Montreal and Brussels. But I've also been working with the two cities separately, looking at emotional experiences of urban life during and after World War I, because I think that's one of the things I talked about was how the book stops in World War I, because all of a sudden the war changes everything. Well, I think that gets said a lot, but we need to think maybe more about what it is that the war changes in a city that does get changed, but even though it's not experiencing the war itself. And then the thing that brought me to Brussels is a separate project that's always been kind of on my back burner, even as I've been working on this, but I'm getting more fully into it this year and hopefully advancing with it, is looking at radio broadcasting in the mid 20th century in Brussels, and thinking about that in terms of the soundscape and the emotional experiences associated with radio as really an important and probably the primary means of communication for a while there in the mid 20th century. So still thinking about some of these issues, but through very different projects now.
Well, that all sounds fantastic, and I'm excited that I know I'll get to talk to you about all of this more. Nicola, thanks so much for joining me and for writing this wonderful book.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and thanks very much for this invitation.